loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. In our first hour, we take a look at three big stories. First, we'll spend our first half hour on so-called Russiagate. As we speak, the Senate Judiciary Committee is meeting to hear the FBI and the Inspector General over the report the IG's office released last week on Comey's behavior. That's James Comey, former FBI director fired by Donald Trump. And other topics. We'll also address Paul Manafort's imprisonment as he awaits trial and the claims that Roger Stone met with a, quote, Russian national, close quote, for dirt on the Hillary Clinton campaign. Then, nearly 2,000 children have been taken from their parents at the U.S.-Mexico border since Attorney General Jeff Sessions announced the policy of separating them several weeks ago. The policy also mandates prosecution of the parents for illegal entry into the United States. Humanitarian and religious groups and even the United Nations have condemned the policy. We'll take a look at this new policy and how it differs from that pursued by the Obama administration. And then Secretary of Defense James Mad Dog Mattis spoke at the graduation of the U.S. Naval War College and laid out the U.S. military's future plans. He castigated Russia and China and prepared the country for major power confrontation. That's the new national security strategy that was unveiled last January.
But before we get to those stories, we'll go over today's headlines, including five that we'll cover in depth in the second hour. First, friends and supporters of Julian Assange are holding two rallies tomorrow at 11 o'clock Eastern Time in Lafayette Square in front of the White House and another at 4:30 at the British Embassy to protest the conditions to which Julian is being subjected inside the Ecuadorian Embassy in London. Julian is not permitted to have internet access, nor is he allowed any visitors other than his attorneys. Next, German Chancellor Angela Merkel accepted a two-week deadline to win agreement on a tougher immigration policy in a concession to her coalition partner. She also announced that the European Union heads of state will likely hold a summit on immigration and refugees June 23rd and 24th. Meanwhile, President Trump today said incorrectly that the German people have turned against Merkel because of immigration and that Germany has become a violent and dangerous place. Then, Iván Duque, the conservative, some would say populist candidate in Colombia, has won that country's presidency with 54% of the vote. He finished 12 points ahead of former guerrilla Gustavo Petro, whose performance was the best ever for a left-wing candidate in one of South America's most conservative countries. Duque promised to heal the rifts among Colombians, but the election revealed that those rifts are wide and deep. And then today we continue our segment, Education for Liberation, with Bill Ayers, where Bill helps us look at the state of education across the country. What's happening in our schools, colleges, and universities, and what impact does it have on the world around us? And finally, today we continue our weekly segment called Connected Lives, Private Profits, with Chris Garaffa. Chris will help us look at technological issues that shape our world and how we can fight to maintain our civil rights and civil liberties in the face of increasingly advanced and sometimes hostile technology. And in other headlines, the Supreme Court declined to make a precedent-setting ruling on the issue of partisan gerrymandering of electoral districts. The court was considering two cases, one brought by Republicans in Maryland and another brought by Democrats in Wisconsin. In both instances, the court made rulings on technical grounds rather than tackling the basic constitutionality of gerrymandering. The United States has reportedly carried out a series of controversial airstrikes in Syria. An Iraqi militia that is part of the popular mobilization forces created to fight ISIS say 22 of their fighters were killed when the U.S. struck their position a few hundred meters from the Iraqi border. Syrian state media also reported a U.S. airstrike targeting government forces in the country's east. The government of UK Prime Minister Theresa May suffered another setback as it tries to negotiate its exit from the European Union. The House of Lords, the unelected upper chamber of the British Parliament, voted today in favor of a plan that would give legislators a bigger say in shaping the final deal with the EU. The May government was hoping to go forward with just a symbolic vote in Parliament. Israeli jets conducted bombing raids across Gaza early this morning, hitting 9 targets. Israeli officials said these attacks were carried out in retaliation for Palestinians flying flaming kites into Israeli territory. These latest bombings further raise tensions following a series of mass shootings carried out by Israeli snipers against Palestinian protesters marching along the Gaza border. Those are today's headlines. Next up is what's new in Russiagate this week, including the 2 p.m. Senate Judiciary hearing with the FBI and Inspector General. You're listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
John Kiriakou, we're going to spend our first half an hour talking about the latest developments in Russiagate. As we speak, the Senate Judiciary Committee is meeting to hear from the FBI and the Inspector General over the report of the Inspector General's office released last week on James Comey's behavior and other topics. We also want to talk about why Paul Manafort is in jail right now before his trial, and also the claims that Roger Stone met with a Russian national, close quote, for dirt on Hillary Clinton. We're joined from Philadelphia by Dave Lindorf. Dave is an investigative reporter, a columnist for Counterpunch, and a contributor to Businessweek, The Nation, Extra, and Salon.com. And we are joined from New York by Daniel Azar. He is a journalist and author of The Frozen Republic, The Velvet Coup, and America's Undeclared War. Daniel and David, welcome back to Loud and Clear.
Thanks for having us.
All right. Daniel Azar, let's start with you. The committee hearing is still going on. Quite interesting. We have the Inspector General explaining why James Comey was insubordinate. Talk about what your takeaway is.
The report was really pretty devastating. It just painted a really unflattering portrait of the FBI. Kind of the gang that couldn't shoot straight, and Comey comes off looking really bad. And Comey was the great liberal hero, and now he's been tarnished. So the question is, what will the Democrats do now? The whole scandal seems to be sinking, seems to be fizzling, running out of steam. And so, where does that leave the Democrats?
Yeah. Okay, where does it leave it? Where does it leave James Comey? Where does it leave Andrew McCabe? Dave Lindorf, your reaction today.
Well, I think Comey is really sunk. He's been touring on his book, and he's been presented as this great man of integrity. And I would agree that the study really really trashes that. It'll make for, if he's still doing his book tour, it'll make for some great questions from the audience on his book tour. And I would expect that is going to happen.
You know, I have to add to that. I think that's exactly right. We've got a situation here where I think most Americans didn't realize how deep into this thing James Comey was. There are some real questions in this report about his leadership, about his integrity. And the Inspector General also told the Senate panel that there's a second investigation now looking at Comey's release of, if not classified information, confidential information. And the Inspector General himself said just this afternoon that such information should never be released, whether it's classified or not. It should never be released. And that's exactly what Comey did. And then he admitted to it.
Yeah. Daniel Azar, Lindsey Graham asked the Inspector General, what's the difference between the language grossly negligent versus extremely careless? Because the original FBI report on Hillary Clinton using a private email server for State Department business, the language that was agreed to in the draft statement was that her conduct was grossly negligent. And yet, after the draft was approved, James Comey appears to have changed the language for his July 5th, 2016 announcement that she was not to be prosecuted because her actions, while bad, were only extremely careless. And the Inspector General was kind of required to admit in this hearing that, well, if it's grossly negligent, that would be a criminal thing.
So Comey was clearly pulling back. But as the IG noted, there was just he had no basis for that public disclosure. I mean, the FBI should not be in the business of dirtying people's reputations if they're not going to indict them. But that's just what Comey did. He accused Clinton of being extremely careless, but there was no statutory basis for that charge.
So the July 5th press conference itself was extraordinary. not normal. And at the same time, it appeared that by using language like extremely careless extremely careless instead of grossly negligent, Comey was also, while chastising her, clearing her from criminal prosecution. I mean, we have both things happening at the same time.
Which decides, who's behaving properly and who's not. It's a criminal investigative body. It's not the arbiter of which politician is performing his job properly. This is quite strange.
Yeah, there's another thing too that's in this Inspector General's. Well, there are two things that really struck me as the most interesting. Number one, it appears that just about all of these players, whether it's Comey or Strozek or whomever, was using a private email account for much of the back and forth. Having been at the CIA for 15 years, I can't even imagine using a private email account for anything. First of all, it's a violation of the Federal Records Act, which in and of itself is a crime. And the other thing is, on page 458 of this report, the Inspector General goes into great detail about the number of leaks that he uncovered. He said that he was shocked at the sheer number, the volume of leaks coming out of the FBI. And not because the leakers were trying to blow the whistle on waste, fraud, abuse, or illegality. They were leaking to journalists in exchange for meals, tickets to sporting events, weekends playing golf. I mean, again, that in and of itself is also a crime. So there's going to have to be a lot of follow-up to this report, because this has become much bigger than just James Comey. This has uncovered a lot of illegality within the FBI.
Dave Lindorf, Christopher Wray, FBI director, said the report shows no bias, but there were errors. He said the FBI needed to learn lessons and teach policies and be better. Anyway, was there bias?
Well, it seems, of course, there was bias. I mean, if Clinton were not a presidential candidate at that time, it would have been a clear case, I think, for most people looking at it as prosecutors or as FBI agents, that she had, as you said, violated the Federal Records Act. As Secretary of State, she was bound to keep all official correspondence indefinitely to be available for freedom of information inquiries and so on, and she simply didn't. And not only that, we know from the early days of reports on that investigation during the campaign that she was actually instructed by the security people at the State Department that she should not be having a server at home and doing business at home on that server, which was not secured or anything. So, she clearly was keeping things secret, and I remember the stories. They involved meetings with people who were giving donations to the Clinton Foundation, and that she was doing business with the Secretary of State. I mean, it was a real pay-to-play kind of business that she was conducting, the kind we're really familiar with here in my town of Philadelphia. Just real, real corrupt behavior. And, they could have gone after her for all of that, and the fact that they didn't is political.
Yeah, Daniel Lazar, let's talk about the text messages between Lisa Page and Peter Strzok. I mean, Peter Strzok is still, I think, the FBI's deputy secretary for counterintelligence. He was in charge working on the Clinton investigation. He was having a romantic affair with Lisa Page. They're texting each other back and forth. Page warns Strzok via text about the FBI's investigation into Clinton's use of a private email server during her tenure as Secretary of State, saying in February 2016 that she, quote, might be our next president. The last thing you need is going in there loaded for bear, she continues. You think she's going to remember or care that it was more DOJ than the FBI? I mean, here's the people in charge of the investigation of Clinton's email server sending text messages back and forth. And they also clearly demonstrate bias later. Go ahead.
Well, I mean, the most famous comment at this point is where Lisa Page texted, Trump is not going to be our next president, right? Right? And Strzok texted back, no, we won't let him. Now, no one knows what that means, but it certainly seems, you know, implies, you know, a great deal. But, you know, so now, what the IG doesn't mention, though, is on another occasion, Strzok, in another text to Lisa Page, described the Russians in general as, quote, and I'm paraphrasing, effing savages. Now, that shows extreme bias towards an entire nation who he was investigating for alleged electoral manipulation. So the FBI is just like, you know, it's rife with bias, crude nationalism, dark threats to stop a presidential candidate to interfere, to itself interfere with the electoral process. I think that there's a real problem over there that has to be fixed.
Yeah, let's go to a Dave Lindorf. Let's go to another text. Quote, this is Peter Strzok, Peter Strzok. I want to believe the path you threw out for consideration in Andy's office, and Andy, as we learn, or confirmed by today's hearing, was, of course, Andrew McCabe, who was the deputy director of the FBI, fired 2 days before he was going to be retired for misconduct. I want to believe that the path you threw out for consideration in Andy's office, that there's no way he gets elected, but I'm afraid we can't take that risk. It's like an insurance policy and the unlikely event you die before you're 40. That's Peter Strzok texting on August 15, 2016, talking about the FBI's conduct as an insurance policy against Donald Trump. I mean, that obviously shows bias. And just again, for our audience, we are not pro-Trump. John Kiriakou is not pro-Trump.
No, indeed
I am not.
Not
pro-Trump. I don't think either of our guests can be ever accused of being pro-Donald Trump. And yet, you can't look at all of this, these facts as they've come out and as they're being discussed today in the hearing, and not come to the conclusion that, in fact, these people did not want Donald Trump to be the president of the United States, and they were in charge of these investigations of Hillary Clinton.
Yeah. No, imagine, you know, you could put a bigger twist on it. Imagine if you had those correspondences after a assassination of President Trump, right? I mean, we've seen all these different assassinations back in the 60s and so on, and you start, when you see something like that, it's like...
and it's very serious because, of course, if anyone went back through the record, in any instance, not just the one you mentioned, but it would certainly leave the impression, and this is what Donald Trump and his supporters are clearly going for right now, is that the entire probe is an extension of an earlier FBI investigation to prevent Trump from becoming president, and that the Russiagate is continuing really as a means or an instrument by these people who were biased against him within the intelligence agencies to further discredit or to bring down his administration after he unexpectedly won the election. I mean, you can't really, I mean, that's going to be Trump's argument. I'm not sure, you know, it'll be credible except among his base, but there's enough here in this report and in these hearings that would make that seem to be true.
Yeah, I don't think it's an unfair stretch to start looking for things like that and trying, you know, imagining it, even if the hard facts aren't there. It, you know, clearly there was an element within the FBI that saw its duty being to prevent Trump getting elected. Comey, by the way, I just want to point out, you know, Comey, as you said, is sort of this liberal icon. He was when he was appointed to head the FBI by Barack Obama. And it's all based on one thing he did, which was on one small part of the Bush massive spying and surveillance campaign that began after 9/11, you know, stood up and prevented it from being forced on a ailing and weakened John Ashcroft in the hospital. But, you know, he's no liberal defender of constitutional freedoms.
I would say the opposite.
Indeed.
I would say the opposite. I mean, and who would ever think
use of these FBI letters? The tech industry, for example, has complained that when efforts were made to prevent the FBI from just willfully looking into people's emails and communications, electronic communications, Comey was pushing for backdoors in their hard, for backdoors being installed in their equipment. He was against all the advice of tech people who were saying it would just be a disaster. But in any case, he was trying to do that. And he also was using these really, really insidious FBI letters, which are most Americans don't even know how these things work, but they're so unbelievably police state. The FBI writes a letter and says somebody is under investigation. They need their documents. They take their computers and search them. They do all this kind of stuff. And you, as an American citizen, are not allowed to tell anybody that it's happening to you. And it can go on for months, even a year.
Because we only have 5 minutes left, I want to also pursue this idea that this is kind of police state tactics overall. Real quick, Daniel, why is Paul Manafort in jail right now? I mean, he went to jail on Friday before his trial. Clearly, when what they're calling witness tampering is an effort, it seems like, by Manafort or some of his friends to clarify to people in the Ukraine, to remind them that what Manafort was really doing in the Ukraine was trying to win over Yanukovych, the Ukrainian government, to look west, to be part of the EU. But anyway, it seems to me to be like an unnecessary jailing, perhaps to put pressure, police state pressure on Manafort. And we're not defending Manafort. He may have committed many, many, many crimes, evading taxes, laundering money. I mean, all of that appears to be very plausible. But nonetheless, the fact that he's been imprisoned now by Mueller, that's to put pressure on him to flip him, because actually without somebody flipping, there's no hard evidence. Go ahead.
I totally agree. I mean, look, whether it's necessary or not, or whether, what Manafort did, whether that merits jailing or not, I don't really know. But clearly Mueller is trying to break the guy. He wants him to testify against Trump with, regarding collusion with Russia. But so far, Mueller has come up dry, but no indication of collusion. And so this strikes me as a desperate last-minute measure to somehow save his investigation. But I just don't think it's going to work.
Not if he gets the VIP treatment in jail. I mean, if you really want to get these guys, you do what they're doing to the DA in Philly, who got indicted for all kinds of corruption, and they locked him up with common criminals.
But they didn't do that with Manafort. He's the only person in the VIP section in this regional jail in Western or Southwestern Virginia. So he's lucky in that respect, because I'll tell you what the feds try to do, what they usually do, is they send you to the DC jail to wait for trial, because they know you're going to get beaten there and softened up, and you'll flip because you'll do anything to get out of a place like that.
Dave Lindorf, we have about two minutes left. Where does this all go? I mean, it goes on and on and on with Mueller. But again, it doesn't appear that there's anything in the Mueller probe about Russia that's demonstrable. And certainly the Trump campaign now has enough ammunition to say, look, this is purely political. It was bias on the part of the FBI.
Yeah, my attitude about all of this is it seems to be one of these now inside the Beltway stories. It has real no consequence. Because you're not going to see Trump get impeached. That's pretty clear. You're not going to see him get indicted. That's pretty clear. And so it's just a lot of noise between the two parties, these two establishment parties, that's going to continue on through certainly this election cycle in November and probably on, through the next presidential election. But we're not going to see it. It's all smoke and mirrors and no results.
Well, the FBI people, though, who didn't want Trump to become president, they're probably not Democrats, some of them at least, and certainly James Comey wasn't. They maybe have other reasons why they did not want Donald Trump to become president of the United States.
Well, he wasn't popular among Republicans either, remember. So in their establishment party, they thought he was going to destroy the party. He may yet destroy it.
All right, we're going to leave it right there. We've been joined from Philadelphia by Dave Lindorf, an investigative reporter, a columnist for Counterpunch, and a contributor to Businessweek, The Nation, Extra, and Salon.com. And we've been joined from New York by Daniel Lazar. He's a journalist and author of The Frozen Republic, The Velvet Coup, and America's Undeclared War. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Nearly 2,000 children have been taken from their parents at the U.S.-Mexico border since Attorney General Jeff Sessions announced the policy of separating them several weeks ago. That policy also mandates prosecution of the parents for illegal entry into the United States. Humanitarian and religious groups, and even the United Nations, have condemned the policy. We'll take a look at it and how it differs from that pursued by the Obama administration. We're joined from Tucson, Arizona by Isabel Garcia. She's the co-founder of Coalición de Derechos Humanos, and she has been helping organize protests against family separation. Welcome back, Isabel.
Thank you so much for having me, Brian and John.
Isabel, the Trump administration said today that they will prosecute 100% of illegal crossing cases. That's unprecedented in American history. Tell us about that decision and how it continues to affect these separations at the border.
Absolutely. We have seen a ramping up, as I've discussed with you guys, over, you know, decades, Democrat administrations, Republican administrations, but never have we seen the callousness and the, I'm sorry, almost the straight up hatred of the people to the South. I mean, I have seen the line going on while they're tearing people away from their children. Then they claim that they don't. Liken it to me committing a crime, getting arrested and taking my children. Imagine that. How can you compare me going out and even if wittingly or not, whether I have a defense or not, my children are not with me. And my children would not be expecting that I would get arrested if I'm dragging them throughout this journey, suffering, and to come into the country and be torn, be really experience the worst torture that a child can experience, short of, you know, being physically, you know, cut up, is to be torn away from the mother. You've seen it. I saw it yesterday at a doctor's office, a 15-month-old being torn away from her mom. Imagine what we're doing here and that they get up and lie. I saw the Border Patrol agent in Texas there, Manuel Peña, just lie about what's going on here and comparing it to that criminal prosecution when we have not in this country decided to prosecute every single crime that's on the books. Oh my God, we wouldn't have any money for anything. So for them to say it's a law on the books, yeah, it's been on the books since, what, 1926, and that they know that people are crossing really still in record low numbers, except the evidence that's coming from us, to us, from those Central American countries. In a sense, they don't want the evidence coming up here, the evidence that we have really mistreated those countries and now to torture them.
Yeah. One of the things that I think people, at least up here, not away from the border, and you're closer to the border, don't understand is what's actually going on. I'm looking at an article from the Texas Monthly, and I want to read a quick paragraph from it and then have you comment, Isabel. There's a big logistical problem because this is a new policy. So the way they get to that policy of taking kids away and keeping adults in detention centers and the kids in a different federal facility is based on the legal rationale that we're going to convict you. And since we are going to convict you, you're going to be in the custody of the U.S. Marshals. And when that happens, we're taking your kids away. So they're not able to convict everybody of illegal entry right now just because there aren't enough judges on the border right now to hear the number of cases that come over. And then if they say have a religious persecution case or political persecution or persecution based on something else, in other words, something that would be within the asylum definition, Still, they are putting people in detention facilities. Now, the person who's who's being interviewed here in the Texas Monthly says, well, are people coming across, why don't they come across if they're seeking asylum at a legal entry point? And the person responds, no one is being allowed to come through the entry point that is legal on the bridge. In other words, you have all of these people who are at a legal entry point with their families. They're being persecuted or they're fleeing persecution or violence, and they're coming to America for asylum, and they shut down the bridge and they sit there for 5 days, 7 days, 10 days. And then finally they get in a raft or something like that, cross the river, and then they're arrested for crossing illegally. In other words, it's a catch-22.
Yes, it's a catch-22. It's exactly what they want. They are holding them for days here, delays, delays. There's no room for you. There's no reason with a multi-billion-dollar budget that they have that they can turn down and say only we can only do two applications per day, knowing full well that people are getting desperate and that they try to cross somewhere else other than the port of entry. And boy, we love it because we're packing our courts with 75 people here a day in the Tucson court alone. I'm wondering what it will be today at 1:30 Tucson court because the weekend generates a lot.
Yeah. So Isabel, so what we're saying is that people, these are people who are seeking asylum. Also, I noticed that the courts have now said that women who are coming seeking asylum because they're the victims of spousal violence, that's no longer considered a possible criteria for acceptance as asylum. So they're sending women back to their abusers. But the government is deliberately creating this crisis by not allowing people who have come seeking asylum to come through a port of entry. They're forcing them to cross illegally or to go back to from where they're fleeing their persecution.
Yeah, some of them don't know where the port of entry is and see a border patrol and go to the border patrol agent to seek help, and they're charged with illegal entry as well. This is a decision made by Stephen Miller. He's an evil man. Sessions and Trump, there is no reason in the record low numbers of crossing. Yes, there's a lot of people crossing from Central America. That should give us pause and say, oh my God, we need to help these individuals. We need, that is what our laws are premised on. We are violating international law. We are violating our own law. And the Border Patrol is out of control, just telling people nilly-willy, there's no room for you. Everybody says that. I mean, you should see the statements that the Border Patrol made to these people. And then we go to court here at 1:30. We're going to see 75 people there. In the course of the courts, and several people every time get up. It used to be that we were noting who was asking for asylum, basically saying, okay, you can give me 30 days, judge, but please don't send me back to Guatemala or El Salvador. And now people are getting up and saying, where's my child? I don't care where I go. Where is my child? I mean, that is cruel. And the judge, imagine being in this expensive, huge, massive courthouse with lots of money and everybody asking each other, where is the child? And nobody can tell that parent where that child is. And Manuel Padilla lied this morning when he said that they know where their children are and all of that. That is not true. And they're not all released with their children.
We're speaking with Isabel Garcia. Isabel joins us from Tucson, and she's the co-founder of Coalición de Derechos Humanos. She's been helping organize protests against family separation. Isabel, Barack Obama was known pretty widely as the deporter in chief and was responsible for deporting more people than any other president. How is this Trump administration policy different than the policy pursued under the Obama administration?
Well, first of all, under the Obama administration, we saw the impact of Clinton and other administrations whereby we saw the largest crossings of people. The largest crossings were happening here in Arizona. We're talking about the people that fled after NAFTA impacted subsistence farming. We saw 6 million people cross illegally into the United States right after NAFTA really implemented in Mexico. And so Obama, had the quote excuse. And so they militarized this border. He created mechanisms that now Trump is utilizing, like on, in a way that is unbelievable. And Obama and the Democrats should have foreseen it. There are no crossings. Look, I graduated in 1971 from high school. We have yet to reach that level of migration into the United States. I don't think people in the United States know that. They see the attention we're giving on these children. They think that the country is being overrun, and that is not true. We should be a civil and kind nation and accept all of these individuals. They're not even that many. And bring them into our country and begin to address the unfair conditions that we have perpetuated in Central America.
Isabel Garcia, let me ask you, if these families seeking asylum were coming, say, a year ago or 2 years ago, would they have been being treated differently than they're being treated right now? Is this a new policy?
Yes, absolutely. Under Obama, they did not separate families. That was policy, unless you had, you know, somebody that they didn't believe or committed really a crime or something. But that was the policy, not to separate families. We were objecting, of course, to some of the conditions that they have in these family detention centers, which are, some of them are horrific. We shouldn't have that. But they kept the families together. Now the policy is being ratcheted up more. It's like, I don't know who we are anymore. We're not following our own laws, and we're not following international law. Do the people in this country understand that? That we are violating laws left and right, and that the Border Patrol has gone out of control in their quest, ICE and Border Patrol, in their quest to have their fat jobs. They are really, really imposing horrific conditions on our communities. We talk about the deaths that we have here at the border. We have the biological deaths, the ambiguous death. People don't ever know what happened to their loved one. And then we have social deaths, the people that we separate. We separate and we keep them apart. We have a family here in Tucson that has lived 10 years now, almost 10 years with her mother in Nogales, Sonora. I mean, that's a social death that people do not talk about. And now to do child abuse, it's unbelievable that we're doing this.
Isabel Garcia is our guest. We're talking about the fact that children, large numbers of children just in the last month have been, as a matter of policy, separated from their children. The U.S. government is not allowing asylum seekers to cross at port of entry. People are even approaching border agents and then being arrested.
I want to add something, too, before we leave. This idea of 100% prosecution for border crossings, this is a very big deal. There's a mandatory minimum sentence at the federal level of 5 years in prison for crossing the border illegally. If you get caught a second time, it's a mandatory minimum of 8 years. Minimum of 8 years. If you're caught a third time, it's 20 years.
No, it can be up to most people that are crossing, you know, here for the first time. They're facing the misdemeanor. But if you've been deported before, and many people have because, they go and visit their family and that sort of thing, then you face the 2 to 20 year phase of penalty.
Exactly right. And the administration now is talking about filling our prisons with undocumented people.
And nobody mentions Jeff Sessions' interest in CCA, now called CoreCivic.
That's right.
That company has benefited. Their stock has gone up 81%.
It's CoreCivic, the country's largest private prison company, that's now in charge of these prisons and camps where the children and the parents are being held.
And they're just, now Sarah Huckabee Sanders is saying it's God's work because the
right.
Bible.
The Bible said so.
The Bible said so.
Oh my God, it's unbelievable when the scripture is being cited here by priests and rabbis. Everybody is quoting scripture for the opposite premise, of course.
Yep, absolutely.
It's shameful. It's shameful. And I'm glad that they're calling for potential, canonical penalties and such on the people that are involved with that very horrific crime of separating the children.
Isabel Garcia is our guest. There's going to be demonstrations. There are demonstrations taking place now all over the country. We're going to keep following it, John.
We will. We're going to have to leave it there, though. We were joined from Tucson, Arizona by Isabel Garcia, the co-founder of Coalición de Derechos Humanos. She has been helping to organize protests against family separation. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Secretary of Defense James Mad Dog Mattis spoke at the graduation of the U.S. Naval War College and laid out the U.S. military's future plans on Friday. He spoke about remaining vigilant against North Korean nuclear threats, preventing Russia from undermining America's moral authority, and standing up to our perceived rival, China. We're joined from Moscow by international affairs and security analyst Mark Sloboda. Mark, welcome back.
Moral authority?
John, Brian, thanks for having me. It's always an honor and a pleasure to be on Loud and Clear.
Thank you.
I heard about this story only this morning, and then when I searched for it, there wasn't a single mention in any mainstream media outlet. DOD issued a press release, and a couple of DOD-specific newspapers had short articles about it, but this was really a major speech. What it did, at least in my view, was to prepare these young naval graduates to go to war. What do you make of this thing?
I do not disagree with that at all. I would simply like to say that this isn't at all unusual. This is pretty much a typical commencement speech at a U.S. military academy. The only place that I saw that it hit the Western mainstream media was Politico had a piece on it. But other than that, I think you're right that it was restricted primarily to, defense-specific U.S. military newspapers and so on. That's the thing. It is not unusual, and this is the type of speech that Mattis and others have been delivering for nearly a decade now.
I'm going to ask you, though, Mark, he refers to the national security strategy. He alludes to it that was issued. I'm not devil's advocating here, but just it seems to me that this is the unveiling of the new national security strategy, preparing the population, in this case, naval graduates, but really the population for major power confrontation. He says Putin seeks to shatter NATO. He said about China that it's harboring long-term designs to rewrite the existing global order. It compares the current Chinese government to the Ming Dynasty, which, according to him, appears to be their model, albeit in a more muscular manner, demanding other nations become tribute states, kowtowing to Beijing, espousing one belt, one road, when this diverse world has many belts and many roads. And then at the end, he says, if you go on, you, Russia and China, go on with your designs, we will meet you and it'll be your longest and last day or something like that. Anyway, isn't it really part of the new rollout of the national security strategy?
Yeah, he definitely pushed all of the buttons of the new national security strategy with its new focus on great power conflict, and in particular, singling out Russia and China as America's two adversaries in the world. I'd actually like to highlight some of the things that he did say during this. First of all, when he mentioned, he says that Putin, he specifically says Putin, that's par for the course, demonizing another country solely through the dehumanization of another country's leader. He specifically said that Putin seeks to shatter NATO, that his actions are not designed to challenge our arms. That is, he doesn't want conventional military conflict with the U.S. He specifically says that. But to undercut our compromise and compromise our belief in our ideals, to undermine America's moral authority. Right there he's talking info war. That's actually what he focuses on there. And as a U.S. military veteran, serving 6 years in the military, to hear him talk about America's moral authority as if it needs another government to challenge it, as if America has moral authority, not just at defense of itself and home, that's another thing, but the problem has always been America's use of military and other types of force around the world in pursuit of hegemony. And the problem, if you look at it historically, of course, you see moral problems, I don't know, maybe with slavery, maybe with the genocide of the Native Americans.
The Vietnam War, Korean War, Iraq War, you know.
Yeah, well, that is all the way up the line. And we have imperialism all over South America, you know, for close to 100 years. We have annexations and amounting to genocide in the Philippines, in the South Pacific, Hawaii, all the way up, of course, into the most recent years with Vietnam, you know, killing one-fifth of the population of North Korea off, the use of Agent Orange, dropping of two nuclear weapons on population centers in Japan, firebombing. Now, on the modern day, extrajudicial, extraterritorial assassination by drones of thousands, kidnapping, torture, regime changes, supporting of Islamists who are literally allied and embedded with Al-Qaeda in Libya. And moral authority? Are you serious? I hope everyone is a little taken aback by that. Now, no one is singling out that America is the single worst country ever in existence, but this type of American exceptionalism, this supremacist ideology, is premised primarily on this perception of moral authority, that when the U.S. can do whatever it wants all over the world, as James Clapper himself recently said, in the media, when we do it, it's for their own good.
Exactly.
And it's that type of hubris, that type of conceit that bothers so many other countries around the world. And this idea that the U.S. has to have absolute security, not only for itself, but it's for its interests, its expansive interests as it sees them around the world, demands, as Putin said in his famous 2007 Munich speech, that every other country's security be compromised.
I want to ask you about that, Mark. Mattis was very specific in this speech, in that he said that there are three things that we as a country need to do to protect American democracy. He said, first thing is we need to maintain a sense of urgency. And he drew a parallel to the situation in North Korea. Second is that we need to see Russia as the nation closest to us in nuclear parity. Brian just mentioned this a few minutes ago. First of all, that's simply factually incorrect. And third, why would that be important to just assume that the Russians are equal to us in nuclear firepower? He said something else that I wanted to ask you about. He said that the only way we can protect this, what he called this experiment in American democracy, is to build up the military even more, because it's Russia, he said, that seeks to destroy NATO. What do you make of all that?
Yeah, well, first of all, I actually disagree with you just a little bit. I think that Russia and the U.S. actually do have nuclear parity. Russia has modernized its nuclear weapons. On the books, it has 200, actually more than the United States. So that part is correct, and that's the basis for mutually assured destruction, which has kept the peace all through the Cold War up until today. That's actually a good thing. That prevents the use of nuclear weapons on the battlefield, something that the U.S. is now trying to do, and with missile defense attempting to disrupt that parity. The parity is a good thing, you know, because people who have such egregious power, if there wasn't parity, would be tempted to use these weapons, as the U.S. has, the only country in the past. Another thing that he specifically mentions there is that Russia has been the nation that has redrawn internet for the first time since World War II. Russia has been the nation that has redrawn international borders by force of arms in Georgia and Ukraine. That is factually incorrect. That's factually incorrect.
That's a big, big lie. Go ahead. Let's talk about, for instance, amongst the many, I mean, or at least several, let's talk about Yugoslavia.
The first one right off the bat is not only the shattering of Yugoslavia with the U.S. Providing open political and armed support for the breakup of Yugoslavia into separate parts, but then specifically with carving Kosovo as a NATO protectorate out of Serbia by the U.S. Use of U.S. bombing and troops, NATO troops on the ground. To this day, and directly assist in putting into government the Kosovo Liberation Army, the KLA, which just a few years before that was recognized as an Islamist terror organization by the U.S. Then they removed that designation when it suddenly became politically convenient to use them as proxies there for the destruction of Yugoslavia. And then we could also talk about East Timor. We could talk about South Sudan. But that is a false fake news, disinformation, however you want to call it, that is simply wrong. And when U.S. government and military officials keep repeating that lie to demonize Russia, and never mind that, of course, that the U.S. was instrumentally involved in political meddling in both Ukraine and Georgia that precipitated Russia's then response and intervention in those countries, that makes that statement a lot more dangerous. And obvious story.
Mark Sloboda is our guest. Mark is talking to us from Moscow about James Mattis' speech before the graduating class of the U.S. Naval Academy. Here's another line, Mark. Let's turn back to China. Quote, and this one really gets me. If you read this speech, I mean, which I'm encouraging people to read it to see how, one, it's propaganda, it's American exceptionalism, it's false. It's preparatory for major power confrontation. But here's about China. Quote, it's unrealistic to believe today that China will not seek to replicate its internal authoritarian model elsewhere as it expands globally. So this is, again, nonsense, but this is the new variant of the export of revolution, which, of course, the U.S. accused the Bolsheviks of doing after the Russian Revolution of 1917. But now China's not seeking to expand other, like a revolutionary framework, just to replicate its internal authoritarian model elsewhere. I mean, that's rubbish.
Not only is it rubbish, but I mean, he uses this lazy retreat into historical analogy referring to the Ming Dynasty as their model. Where he gets this from, I don't know. I mean, could we talk about the U.S. exporting their founding fathers, constitutionally enshrined policy of slavery around the world? I mean, I wouldn't do that because that would be historically and factually incorrect, right? And for him to do so is just lazy. He talks about China in that model wanting to make other states tributary states, kowtowing to Beijing, rather than say kowtowing to Washington, because I seem to remember Nikki Haley at the UN saying that she's taking a list of names of countries that vote against the U.S.
Any of you who don't kowtow, I've got your name. I've got your name.
I'm a little shocked by that. And then the kicker in that part about China for me was when he referred to Chinese use of predatory debt, using predatory economics of piling massive debt on others. Hello, Washington Consensus, U.S. development plans, neoliberal U.S. development plans for the future. And, of course, what he's talking there about is China passing massive debt on the United States, because the United States, with its now $21 trillion just in federal debt, not to mention state and cities and everything else, it adds up to over $60 trillion. But referring to the $2 trillion that the U.S. owes to China. And I don't remember China forcing debt down the U.S. government's throat.
Exactly. China has, I think it's about $3 trillion in securities, American securities that it's purchased. So maybe Mattis wants them to dump the currency? What do you think? Anyway, 30 seconds.
Yeah, Russia just dumped half of its U.S. Treasury bonds this weekend, and China dumped another three. Japan has also dumped some. So I think that's a response to Trump's economic policies. Yeah, but this speech is pure hubris. The guy, the mad dog, who said that it's fun to shoot people in Afghanistan and be polite, be professional, but have a plan to kill every single person you meet, lecturing the rest of the world, the other major powers, on moral authority? Oh, it's too much. It's too much.
That was the voice of Mark Sloboda. Mark joined us from Moscow. He's an international affairs and security analyst. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Loud and clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.